Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, happy Earth Day. It's hard to believe, but it's been 5 Earth Days since the Deepwater Horizon exploded, rupturing a pipeline to millions of gallons of sub-seabed oil. The subsequent fouling of the Gulf of Mexico killed unknowable numbers of creatures across the biome and virtually destroyed a way of life for those in the region making their living from the sea. Even today, years after the fact, the region still bears the scars of the spill, as do the thousands who worked cleaning up the Deepwater Horizon's aftermath. Dar Jamal is an Olympic Peninsula-based freelance journalist and author whose book titles include The Will to Resist: Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, Beyond the Green Zone: Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Iraq, and the contributed chapter Killing the Intellectual Class for the anthology Cultural Cleansing in Iraq, Why Museums Were Looted, Libraries Burned, and Academics Murdered. Jamal is also a Truth Out staff reporter. In his latest book, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible, is co-written with Truth Out founding editor William Rivers Pitt. Among Dar's many journalism awards are the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the Lannan Foundation Writing Residency Fellowship, the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism, the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and 4 Project Censored Awards. His work has appeared at Truth Out and many other places online, and including The Guardian, Foreign Policy and Focus, Le Monde, and Interpress News Service, and at his own website, darjamal.net. In 2010, Dar applied the same rigorous determination to reveal the truth of the Iraq War to the global environmental crisis, focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption, including the emblematic Deepwater Horizon disaster. Dar Jamal in the first half. And from the Gulf of Mexico to the Eastern Pacific to the Beaufort Sea and Hibernia, North America is ringed from coast to coast to coast with offshore oil interests determined to have their way come hell or deep water. The latest target of big oil's interests is Baffin Bay's Davis Strait, where the Norwegian company Petroleum Geoservices Inc. has received the blessing of Canada's National Energy Board, or NEB, to begin seismic testing for oil and gas believed to lay beneath the ocean bottom there. But, and it's a big but, it seems the Inuit community of Clyde River, the people that happen to live up there, are opposed to Petroleum Geoservices' plan to deploy high-decibel sound blasting equipment in their fishing grounds. Nader Hassan is lead attorney for the plaintiffs of Clyde River. Hassan specializes in constitutional and human rights cases brought against government and police and has acted for victims of police abuse, the wrongfully convicted, and asylum seekers. Nader Hassan and the village of Clyde River taking a stand against the petro giants in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher emeritus Janine Bancroft has been called away on a vital mission, so won't be joining us at the bottom of the hour. But first up, Dar Jamal on Earth Days Past and those to come. Stick around. Welcome back to the program, Dar.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
Well, it's always my pleasure. Of course, you know that. Now, Dar, why way back when, those many Earth Days passed, did you decide to pick up and get down to the Gulf just after the Deepwater disaster?
Well, I'm from Houston originally, and I spent some of my favorite times in childhood down in Galveston in the Gulf of Mexico fishing and playing on the beach and that kind of thing, and actually just happened to be living in West Texas much later in 2010 when the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded, and was wanting to start changing my focus more into environmentalism and climate change. And so with that happening, it was just the obvious segue for a lot of the aforementioned reasons. And I felt really passionate about the Gulf of Mexico and it being polluted. And, you know, I had a close personal attachment to it. And so had the opportunity to go down there and start covering it. And so that's how it all started.
Well, now, there's different narratives 5 years later. I've seen some on the television, and it reminded me of the late and lamented Danny Schechter, who said, the more you watch, the less you know. And according to some sources on the American mass media, everything's okay. Tourism is back up along the Gulf. There's some tar balls here and there, but, you know, no problem. Is that should I be confident and book my holiday down there next?
Absolutely not. You know, the so-called good news on the situation is only coming from BP's propaganda machine. You know, they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, literally, in whitewashing this deal via running op-eds in regional newspapers to national television ads to ads in bigger papers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And you know, their line is always going to be that we're doing everything we can, things are better, the Gulf's back to normal, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you just scratch just a little bit below the surface and go and talk to some of the scientists studying the impacts on the ecology, talk to the marine biologists along the Gulf Coast, those who are not bought and paid for by BP, that is, and, or talk to the fisher folks who are going out there trying to struggle to make a living in the aftermath of this. And across the board, you're going to hear a lot of the same stories, and that's that there hasn't been much of a recovery, that in some instances things have been beaten all the way down, like in the oyster industry, and not come back hardly at all. And in others, like shrimping, et cetera, it's still a pretty dismal situation. And so it's really a situation where across the board, you're going to be hard-pressed to find anyone living down on the Gulf Coast whose livelihood depends on the health of the Gulf who's going to say, yeah, things are back to normal. I think, you know, almost across the board, you're going to hear that we're still struggling to know we're completely, absolutely wiped out and our lives will never be the same again.
Well, and I hear, too, that there's been sightings of dolphins floating up. Now, I'm sure dolphins die all the time, but, I mean, dolphins in numbers and dolphins together showing up dead is pretty rare.
That's right. It is true. There's a baseline mortality of dolphin deaths and, you know, finding the occasional body of a dolphin. But, no, there's been literally record numbers, and these are even according to NOAA numbers, record numbers of dolphin deaths, and more importantly even than that, prenatal dolphin deaths of baby dolphins and stillbirths and things like this that they've been finding every year since the spill.
And can we confidently say that the chemicals that were leached into both from the subsurface and the Corexit that came afterwards are responsible for these deaths? Do we know?
Yeah, that's a fact. Again, you can talk. There's NOAA scientists, which are, you know, federally government paid scientists, that will speak to that directly and say exactly that, as well as numerous other wildlife biologists, marine biologists, and I've interviewed several of them personally at a lot of the institutions around the Gulf Coast, like Louisiana State University or University of Georgia, et cetera, who will speak directly to. This is it's very, very clear when you introduce almost 5 million barrels of oil and over 2 million gallons of toxic dispersants, and when you mix them together, it creates a substance 40 times more toxic than either of them individually, and spread it over a massive swath geographically of the Gulf of Mexico, and it happens to be right in the middle of the fishing industry, then you're going to have massive, widespread ecological problems. And, you know, for example, Dr. Andrew Whitehead, who was with LSU at the time of the spill, I interviewed him. He had a study on the killifish, the Gulf killifish, which is one of the bases of the entire food chain in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a tiny minnow that lives in the marsh. And he documented in a report published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Okay, you're not going to get any more prestigious than that, saying directly that killifish's anatomy, their hearts, their respiratory systems are all being very negatively impacted by chemicals directly from BP's oil. And if that's happening to the species that forms the base of the food chain in the entire Gulf of Mexico, and given that the chemicals in both the crude oil and the dispersants used to sink the oil, those chemicals are bioaccumulative, meaning they go up the food chain so that when something bigger than the killifish eats it, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on up to us eating food coming directly out of the Gulf of Mexico, we are eating those chemicals as well.
Well, and I understand, I heard a story about the barrier islands, these mangrove islands that are nurseries to so many species. They, too, have suffered because of the pollution.
Absolutely. It's basically anything coming into contact via water, the food chain, or air of that area is being directly impacted. And this is why you see, or in me and a lot of other reporters who've covered it from this perspective have seen, that when you even talk to people that don't even live directly on the coast, but people living 5-10 miles inland, depending on weather conditions on any particular day, they're getting impacted by the chemicals coming off the Gulf of Mexico, and have had such extreme health impacts that they've gone to doctors and had blood draws and had tests taken. A Metamatrix test is the most common one to see if they have any of these chemicals in their blood. And sure enough, the vast majority of the people I've spoken with who've gone and had that test have tested in the high percentile of having those chemicals in their blood.
Yeah, this is, I saw a video, you know, of course, about the Vancouver spill that was recently, and a smidgen compared, but the reaction of the people that use these beaches, because it was right in Vancouver, very popular beach spots, a lot of the regular citizens, because government was absent, went down there with no protective gear at all, maybe save some rubber gloves, and were literally scrubbing oil off of rocks, and I couldn't help but think of what kind of health risks they were running in doing just that.
Well, absolutely, they're exposed. And, you know, you look at the fact that the plight of the cleanup workers from the BP spill, and you can look up the coast of the Exxon Valdez 26 years ago and see the same thing, mm-hmm. that you know, all these cleanup workers are being exposed to extremely hazardous substances. I mean, it's easy for us to take for granted, and I think a lot of people forget that crude oil is technically a hazardous material because it's full of toxic chemicals, you know, hexane, benzene, xylene, toluene. I mean, go on down the very, very long list of known carcinogens. And so, and other things that cause central nervous system damage, respiratory damage, cardiovascular problems, memory loss. I mean, there's a long list of problems just from the oil itself. So if anyone goes out there and is breathing it in on a regular basis, say during a cleanup, even like what you guys experienced up there, then those people are going to have long-term health ramifications without a doubt.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. Speaking tonight with Dar Jamaan. Dar is based just across the water here on the Olympic Peninsula. He's a freelance journalist and author, best known for his books, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Iraq. And his latest book is The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible. Well, Dar, I mean, I made a joke about the mainstream media, but the reportage on these disasters, especially the deep water, is no joke. You were used to covering war zones, you know, super dangerous, high security areas. How does that compare to trying to get coverage when you were down in the Gulf of the aftermath of the deep water?
Well, one commonality would be that covering both stories, meaning the U.S. occupation of Iraq and then the deep water horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, one commonality was that the mainstream media was largely beholden to corporate power. So in Iraq, for example, I was up against the mainstream media in the U.S. that was extremely biased towards supporting the war for years into the occupation, even though it was proving to be a dismal failure from the very beginning. And the same thing, and yet then as a journalist being way ahead on that story, not necessarily ahead, but if I was choosing to report as I was, the facts on the ground, and then that comes up against the propaganda in the mainstream media, being that I'm the little guy, I'm the independent guy on the ground, of course, I'm going to catch a lot of flack for that. Of course, a lot of those folks later came around and, you know, I mean, my time bore out the accuracy of my reporting. And the same thing happened in the Gulf of Mexico, where, you know, the BP, the propaganda machine, was working overdrive. The mainstream media, while you know, were at least at times somewhat critical of BP, at the end of the day would fall in line and not really report the facts on the ground as they were developing. And yet I was breaking stories about Gulf seafood deformities and things like this, and then, of course, being attacked in the same way, kind of like what I experienced in Iraq, by simply reporting the truth. And yet, you know, here we are 5 years on the, you know, the five-year anniversary of the spill, and my reporting from 5, 4, 3 years ago, it's as accurate now as it was then, and yet it's very, very clear that still we're up against a massive propaganda machine, which is fueled, you know, or really perpetuated largely by the corporate press in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there continues to be a relatively stark contrast between my reporting that you're going to see in the mainstream regarding the BP disaster.
Well, and not just the corporate media, but also the corporations that seem to have moved into media. I read just the other day that BP, British Petroleum, the authors of the Deepwater disaster, were actually writing a camera-ready copy and production of tourism videos for Louisiana.
Absolutely, and I actually did a story that touched on that a ways back. I mean, they hired Ogilvy Associates, an international PR firm, to literally go in there and spin stories. And you can go online and find videos of guys giving talks who were working for Ogilvy, talking specifically to college students in the United States, telling, hey, here's what we did. These stories would come up. You know, Tony Hayward, BP's CEO at the time of the disaster, made that famous quip, "I just want my life back," and the media went crazy on it. And then, the Ogilvy guy talking about, hey, here's how we had to spin that story. You know, we had to get out there and have him come back and say certain things. And so, I mean, it's very, these people are, there's no secret. They hired spin doctors. They hired professional propagandists to basically run the media, to work social media for them. I've done stories on how they'll hire trolls. They've hired paid trolls to go online and harass people on Facebook pages who are anti-BP or critical of BP, and find these people and harass them and make threats and this kind of thing. So it's a very, very insidious thing, but, it's not a big surprise if you look at the amount, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars at stake for a corporation, and when that kind of money's at stake, it's not a surprise to see corporations are going to go to any lengths to silence their critics. And this has been proven time and time again in one huge story after another, whether you talk about the lawsuit against Big Tobacco here in the U.S. several decades ago, or what's happened with BP, or things with Monsanto. But when critics start really speaking up and then start to affect economic damage to that company, then the company is obviously going to fight back and try to protect its interests.
Well, and the timeliness, the importance of timely reporting in the Deepwater case was because you were writing, and there were others too, writing about the dangers Corexit posed to the environment, that it would be worse, that it was basically a PR stunt to get the oil below the surface where it wouldn't be so photogenic for what media was there covering it. And yet, they went ahead anyway and inflicted a double ding-dong there pollution-wise.
That's right, and it is clear that the dispersants they used are we don't have a full list of the ingredients in them, but with what we do know for sure is in them, they are extremely toxic and carcinogenic, and all the things I mentioned earlier, talking about the human health consequences, and not just human health consequences, but obviously impacts on the ecological zones and the impact zone of the Gulf of Mexico. And so it's clear, I've written about Malco, the company that makes the dispersants, and that it's the fact that there's a member on BP board who is also on the board of Malco. I mean, there's all kinds of ties. It's very, very clear. And also the fact that using dispersants to this day, despite all the scientific evidence showing how harmful, how deadly this chemical is, using dispersants remains one of the key tools in oil spill response in the United States. And I don't know if it's the case in Canada. I'd be actually surprised if dispersants were not there, available for oil spill response up there. But it's a deadly chemical, and if and when they're used, again, it's going to go deep into the food chain, and ultimately we're spraying chemicals that we're going to end up ingesting ourselves if we eat anything that comes out of the ocean.
Yeah, well, and that's the other point here. And sadly, in Canada, information is so difficult to come by. All we're promised is a world-class response, and the government in Canada, the federal government, responsible for to manage what happened in Vancouver recently, they stuck to that line, saying even though nobody showed up for almost a full day, that was the world-class response we got. Thankfully, I don't believe they poured any Corexit on it, but that might be part of the plan. I don't know. Well, Dar, we're fast running out of time, but I can't let you go before saying, well, the last time we talked, you were working on a story about what the U.S. Navy plans to do right across the water from us over the Olympic Peninsula, your home, mainly with these Growler airplanes. Do you want to? And there was a great letter to the editor of Focus Magazine citing your article just recently, by the way. But do you want to reiterate for those that missed the first show, Dar, what the Navy plans to do and where we are along the continuum of that process?
Yeah, I've done three stories on this now, and I'm actually packing up to head out to do some more reporting on this. It's going to result in at least probably two or three more stories, but it's something that folks there in Victoria need to pay very special attention to, because you are absolutely going to be impacted if this moves forward. And basically what's going on is the U.S. Navy has a massive air station on Whidbey Island, just across the water from me and you, and they have Growler jet aircraft there. It's F-18 Growler is the name of the jet. It's the single loudest jet aircraft ever constructed on the planet, and they're going to use them to conduct electromagnetic warfare training on the Western Olympic Peninsula. So that means they would be, and they're bringing in more Growler to add to the fleet that's already there at the air station on Whidbey Island. So it would bump it up to over 100 jets in total there. And if they get their way this coming September, they'd be flying these jets in 1s, 2s, and 3s out the Strait of Juan de Fuca west to the Western Olympic Peninsula, flying them around as low as 1,200 feet off the deck and conducting electromagnetic warfare training. They'd have at least 13 mobile units on the ground putting out signals. The jets would be flying around very close trying to pick up those signals. The Navy claims they would not be emitting any radar or any harmful radiation, but at the same time, their environmental impact statement notes that anyone standing, for example, for 15 minutes near one of their ground-based emitters, they'd have to stand there for 15 minutes before their eyes melted. So clearly there's some human impact there. Even very, very low levels of electromagnetic radiation there's been countless studies and scientific reports showing they deleteriously affect wildlife, particularly affecting birds, their bio-navigational abilities. It throws them completely out of whack. We're talking about at least two endangered species out here that are in the crosshairs of this training exercise. So it's a very, very distressing situation. Sound pollution is going to be an obviously huge impact across the whole strait. You guys are probably already hearing that already, and what you're hearing would increase dramatically, both in frequency and intensity, if the Navy gets its way. So that's one aspect of this, and I know we're running out of time. There's many others, but where the story is save a big environmental law firm stepping in and basically filing a lawsuit against the Navy and slowing this situation down. It does look like it's on track. There's a lot of outcry over on this side of the strait. I know there has been some over there. One of your MPs has written letters to the U.S. Ambassador of Canada, but clearly more action needs to be taken if this thing's going to be stopped.
Well, we'll touch base on this as the date comes closer, Dar. And as you say, yeah, we're fast out of time. Thanks a lot, Dar Jamal, darjamal.net, for his work, and happy Earth Day to you, eh?
Thanks a lot, Chris. Likewise.
All right, then. Bye-bye. I'm going to take a brief break, and when I come back, as I said, Janine's not going to be here today, so I'm going to try to fill her usual spot with interesting stuff, so why don't you stick around and find out what that is. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, and what I'm doing now, and as you can tell with limited success, is trying to set up something on the computer here to play. As I said, Janine's been called away, but I know that she is a huge fan of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia, you may recall if you listen to the show, was taken from a prison, deathly sick, to the hospital. He had gone into an undiagnosed diabetes shock, and it really was a shock to a lot of people, not only that he didn't even know he had this disease, but that it had been allowed to progress to such a level that he had to be taken to hospital near death. He'd already, according to my last week's guest, Dave Lindorf, who wrote a book about Mumia's case and his long imprisonment, he had to be taken, you know, as I said, to the hospital, and he had already lost 80 pounds before actually succumbing to this shock, you know. So, I mean, the prison officials there watched a guy lose 80 pounds and didn't think that it was an issue. So what I'm going to do, though, because this guy is fighting back, so I'm going to play some music, and then I'll come back and hook up this computer thingy here. So in the meantime, why don't you listen to a local band? I think I got this thing figured out, but I'm not really sure. Yeah, that's... No, it isn't. Jeez. All right.
Altura donde el sol de tu bravura le puso un cerco a la muerte. Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Vienes quemando la brisa con soles de primavera para plantar la bandera con la luz de tu sonrisa. Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia. nueva empresa donde esperan la firmeza de tu brazo libertario. Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia. Seguiremos adelante, como junto a ti seguimos, y con Fidel te decimos, hasta siempre, comandante.
There it is. I finally found the button that I wanted. Here's the piece from Momia's writings. Here you go.
Ferguson, USA. With breathless news reports, the U.S. Department of Justice's pattern and practice study paints a damning picture of a long, cruel, and bitter train of maltreatment, mass profiling, police targeting, and brutality against black people in the Missouri town of Ferguson. What may be even worse, however, is how the town's police, judges, and political leaders have conspired to loot the community by fining them into more poverty. Fines which today account for some 25% of the county's budget. Correctly, cops have been criticized for their juvenile emails and texts of racism and contempt against the local black community and even black leaders in Washington, D.C. There is largely silence, however, over the role of judges who use their robes to squeeze money from the community with unfair fines and fees, even using their jails as an illegal kind of debtor's prison. In 1869, during the reign of England's Queen Victoria, a statute known as the Debtors Act was passed, which forever abolished imprisonment as punishment for debt. In today's Missouri, it's still used to punish the poor. But truth be told, it ain't just Missouri. Famed Rolling Stone writer Matt Taibbi, in his 2014 book, The Divide, tells a similar tale, but from points all across America. Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, Gainesville, Georgia, L.A., San Diego, and beyond. Poor people are being squeezed and squeezed by cops, by judges, by local governments to part with their last dime to support a system that's corrupt to the core. Taibbi's full title might give us better insight. The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. It's the system, one of exploitation, of predation, ultimately of capitalism from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's for Janine. And yeah, as I said, Mumia was taken. He seems to be recovering right now, but you know, this guy's been in jail since 1981 in solitary confinement for the vast majority of that. So, well, anyway, from the Gulf of Mexico to the Eastern Pacific to the Beaufort Sea and Hibernia's in North America, the continent is ringed from coast to coast to coast with offshore oil interests determined to have their way come hell or deep water. The latest target of big oil's interest is Baffin Bay's Davis Strait, where the Norwegian company Petroleum Geoservices Inc. has received the blessing of Canada's National Energy Board, or NEB, to begin seismic testing for oil and gas believed to lay beneath the ocean bottom there. But There's a small problem. The Inuit community of Clyde River is opposed to Petroleum Geoservices' plan to deploy high-decibel sound blasting equipment in their fishing grounds. They believe the testing will harm the wildlife they depend on for their livelihood, and they've taken the NEB to Canada's courts to prove it. For its part, the NEB says it's initiated, quote, a lengthy, detailed, open process that was well-designed to share and gather information to hear and take into account the concerns put forward by the applicants. Well, the hearings were on Monday last in Toronto. Nader Hassan is lead attorney of, for the plaintiffs of Clyde River. Hassan specializes in constitutional and human rights cases brought against government and police and has acted for victims of police abuse, the wrongfully convicted, and asylum seekers. He's a partner with the prestigious Toronto law firm Ruby Schiller Chan and Hassan. Nader also maintains an active appellate practice. He's also an adjunct professor of law at the U of Toronto's Faculty of Law, where he teaches on crime and punishment and lectures on civil liberties issues. He's an associate editor of the Canadian Rights Reporter. Nader has also is a co-author with Clayton Ruby and Gerald Chan of the book Sentencing, and co-authored with Chan a forthcoming book on privacy rights and digital technologies. Welcome to the program, Nader.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you sound like a super busy guy, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Well, first of all, what happened on Monday? How did the hearing go?
You know, the hearing went very well. The three judges of the Federal Court of Appeal who were hearing the judicial review were very engaged. They asked a lot of incisive and intelligent questions. We made all the points and all the arguments we wanted to make, and now the ball is in the court's court, so to speak, and we await their decision anxiously.
Well, and anxious is, I guess, the key word here, because the clock is ticking. Nature doesn't wait for anybody, and the fishing season, you know, the big melt is on the way. So, I mean, have they made any promises that they're going to come up with a decision in time to stop, if it should go that way, or delay at least the testing commencing this year?
Well, no, they haven't made a promise per se. That said, the court is alive to our concerns about the urgency of the matter. We brought a motion to expedite the hearing precisely because the proponents plan to start their seismic blasting when the ice breaks in Baffin Bay, and that's usually around July. So they're aware of our concerns, and they expedited the hearing so that we could have a hearing and hopefully get a decision well before July.
Well, now, what's at issue here? It seems that it's a pretty obvious case from your clients. They're afraid that this blasting is going to disrupt the wildlife. It's going to chase away the fish that are eaten by whales and so on. I mean, why is this not just a cut and dried issue?
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned in the introduction to this segment that they believe the seismic blasting will harm marine mammals and fish. Yeah, they believe it, but that belief is grounded in scientific fact. The science of marine biology is pretty clear now that seismic blasting is harmful to fish and marine mammals. And this is an area of the world. These waters are home to a tremendously diverse array of marine mammals, including the narwhal, including the bowhead whale, the ringed seal, the bearded seal, and it's beyond dispute that seismic blasting is harmful to these animals if they're in close proximity. And even if they're many kilometers away, migration routes can be disrupted, and sensory disruption can occur. And because these are, you know, icy waters, if migration routes are disrupted, then many of these animals can become trapped in ice. A lot of narwhals were killed in the 2008-2009 seismic testing season that was occurring off the coast of Greenland. So the scientific evidence is pretty strong that seismic testing is harmful. And it's not simply a matter of concern for these marine mammals, although that is, of course, important in and of itself. But the people of Clyde River and the region, the Kikikani region, which is Baffin Island, they depend on these marine mammals for their food security, as they have for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. You got to understand, Chris, that up there, you can't just walk into your supermarket and buy all your nutritious food the way we do further south, because it's prohibitively expensive. Supermarket food is all imported from points south, And so, you know, a few pounds of low-grade roast beef will cost you $50. A small bunch of grapes will cost you in excess of $20. So the way that many people up there access nutritious food is eating marine mammals, as they have for hundreds of, if not thousands of years. So the narwhal, the ringed seal, certain other whale species, is how they get nutritious food. So this case, at the end of the day, it's really about the right to eat and the ability to access nutritious food.
Yeah, and of course the narwhal, the unicorn of the sea, a highly charismatic species. And am I right, Nader, that it's 80-some-odd percent of the world's known narwhals are in this narrow area of Davis Strait?
My understanding is 90%.
Wow, there you go.
That use this area as their wintering area.
Well, now there's not just Clyde River. There's opponents of this type of development. These seismic tests, it's come from all areas of Nunavut, and yet the governments in Nunavut they're not signed on with you and the Clyde River people in this case. Why is that?
You know, I think that's probably a question for the powers that be. We have received a groundswell of support, both within Nunavut and outside Nunavut, across Canada and all over the world. The Baffin Island Mayors Association passed a unanimous resolution supporting us. Every Baffin Island community has come out publicly in support of us. The regional organization, the Kikiktani Inuit Association, has enthusiastically supported this lawsuit, and in fact, I think they just released another press release today saying they support it wholeheartedly. You know, the reason why Clyde River was left holding the bag and doing it themselves and taking the initiative was simply a matter of practicality. The National Energy Board, and this is perhaps another area where they were a little bit tone deaf, issued its decision approving the seismic testing license in late June of last year. And June in Nunavut is a time where most people are out at their camps, and it's difficult to get people together. And to appeal a decision of the National Energy Board, you only have 30 days. So even for getting the Clyde River City Council and the Clyde River Hunters and Trappers organization together, that in and of itself was a tall order. But thanks to the intrepid nature of Mayor Jerry Natanen, we were able to get the powers that be together, and he on behalf of Clyde River were able to give me proper instructions to mount this lawsuit. But so that was, I think, the initial reason why it was Clyde River acting on its own that brought this challenge. But since then, you know, everyone's been behind us in Nunavut, with the exception perhaps of the NTI and which is the Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated, which is sort of the national level organization. We haven't heard much from them.
Well, and for the Canadian government's part, Bernard Valcourt, he's the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development. Sort of an oxymoronic sort of title, in my own view, or at least it suggests a bias right off the top. But you know, he says he's fine with this. That the plan is good. That the NEB says that they did proper consultation, and they didn't get any opposition. And as you mentioned, I guess everybody was out working at the time, holding a meeting during the Super Bowl or some such. But so the Canadian government isn't going to be much help on this, and you got to go to a Canadian government court. I mean, you're playing in their ballpark, of course. So what kind of odds of success can we hope for here?
Well, you know, you bring up Minister Valcourt, and the various Inuit associations and organizations and groups repeatedly throughout the National Energy Board process implored the minister and the Canadian government to get involved and to conduct a strategic environmental assessment and to begin talks with Inuit groups about, you know, how this can be done properly. And Minister Valcourt essentially said, you know, we're not going to get involved. We're going to leave it to the National Energy Board and the proponents, the industry proponents, to spearhead this process. So that in and of itself was a mistake. It's a dereliction of the Crown's constitutional duty, because under the Canadian Constitution, Inuit and Aboriginal persons are owed a duty to consult when the government proposes to do something that will affect their Aboriginal rights. And that duty resides with the Crown, acting through the federal or provincial government. And so for the federal government to essentially say, we're going to be hands-off and let the industry proponents and the National Energy Board do their thing is not just dubious as a matter of policy, it's unconstitutional. And that's part of our argument as to why the process was inherently flawed, because the duty to consult was not met. As for the question about, you know, playing in their ballpark, you know, in Canada we do have a separation of powers, and we do have the rule of law, and I'm confident that we have judges in this country who respect that separation of powers, and that if the evidence is properly marshaled and the legal arguments are made in a compelling way, that we will see justice at the end of the day.
And what about the issue of the maritime boundaries? If this Norwegian company wants to do its tests outside of the, you know, the legal boundaries, though still having the same kinds of effects on sea life that they would whether they were which side of that line they were on, irregardless, how does that play in legally if they're outside of our jurisdiction?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question, and indeed this project does take place outside Nunavut in Canada's 12 nautical mile boundary from the coast, which is why this is under NEB jurisdiction and not one of the Nunavut bodies. But you know, obviously the walrus knows no man-made boundaries. The narwhal isn't familiar with our political boundaries. And if you go a few miles from Canada's territorial boundary and conduct your seismic testing there, it's still going to have transboundary impacts inside Canada's territorial waters, and it's still going to affect the rights of Canadians and the Inuit within Canada's territorial boundaries. So the fact that it takes place outside of Canada's territory is, in my view, a bit of a red herring, because the effects are still felt.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking tonight with Nader Hassan, and he's lead attorney for the plaintiffs of Clyde River. He specializes in constitutional and human rights cases brought against government and police, and has acted for victims of police abuse, the wrongfully convicted, and asylum seekers. He's with the prestigious partnership of Ruby Schiller Chan and Hassan. And Nader, how is it that your firm, you guys are a big wheel and way down in the big smoke, how is it that you got involved with this case from such a distant client?
Yeah, I mean, I ask myself that question slightly differently, which is, how could I not become involved once I heard about what was going on, and once I was approached by the client? You know, this is an extremely important case, and like I said at the outset of this segment, you know, what it comes down to is the right to eat, and the survival of an entire people is at risk here. Mm-hmm. If this goes wrong, then the food source that the people of Kikiktani region have survived on for hundreds of years will be decimated, and their entire way of life will have been destroyed. And it's entirely preventable. It's preventable if we do things the right way. And my clients are not anti-development. They're not even anti-oil. They just want to have a say in the process, because there's too much at stake for them. If the oil companies go up there and they explore and they cause all kind of damage, then, you know, once they've reaped their profits, they're gone. But my clients have to live there, and they have to live with the consequences of what happens up there. And if the costs of so-called development are that their entire way of life is annihilated, well, it's just not worth the risk. And there's really no way of them to know what the risks are, because they weren't consulted and they weren't involved in the process and they weren't involved in shaping the process.
Yeah, well, and this is your opposite number, defending the NEB decision, insists, though, that there was proper consultation made and that everybody had their chance. And she seemed to make a big point of that there wasn't a lot of reaction. And she tried to paint this as a single disgruntled community led by maybe a maverick mayor or something, and not representative of the greater community in Nunavut.
Yeah, that's deeply unfair, I was very disappointed with that argument. My heart goes out to the mayor who was in the gallery in the Toronto court. The hearings were simulcast to a courthouse in Iqaluit, so that people in closer proximity to the affected areas could have a chance to observe the hearings live. And my heart goes out to them too, because I know how difficult it must have been for them to watch the lawyer for the proponents say, "Oh yeah, they were consulted, and this is a maverick mayor," when they know in their heart of hearts that wasn't the case. The proponents treated so-called consultation as a box to tick in their checklist so that they could tell the NEB that they consulted. But it wasn't meaningful. And I'll just give you one example, and it was an example I gave in court this past Monday. They claimed to have been engaging in community meetings and consultations for years, and then the NEB held a couple of public information sessions, and people attended these public information sessions. They were well attended. And time after time, people would get up and say, "Tell me what the effect of seismic testing is on the narwhal." "Oh, sorry, we don't have that information. We'll have that sent up to you." "Tell me what the effects are on the polar bear." "Oh, sorry, we're not the marine biology people. We'll have that information sent up to you." "Tell me what your plan is to compensate the Inuit if something goes wrong." "Oh, you know, that's something that's going to require a lot of back and forth. We don't have an answer for you on that." And this was at the end of the process. You know, how is it that if there was really meaningful engagement that companies could have been taken by surprise by these questions?
Mm-hmm.
It baffles the mind. You know, even the NEB said that there wasn't meaningful consultation up to that point, and they suspended the review process for a period and asked the companies to respond to the questions that the communities had put to them. So that was good. But then what happened was the companies submitted a 4,000-page document to the NEB that was supposed to be responsive, only in English. There was a few pages that were translated into Inuktitut, but 4,000 pages on the Internet, and that was it. And now, of course, many people in Nunavut don't have access to the Internet. Some people don't read English that well, and this was predominantly in English. And if there was to be meaningful consultation, and if this document was supposed to provide all the answers, well, then that document ought to have been the beginning of a process of meetings and consultations rather than the end. And that's where I think the NEB made a huge mistake. They accepted that omnibus submission as being good enough, when clearly under our constitutional law, you have to have meetings, you have to have engagement, you have to give the affected Aboriginal or Inuit group a say in the process, and it wasn't. It was presented to them as a fait accompli, and that's why it was fatally and constitutionally flawed.
Yeah, well, we in British Columbia have a lot of experience with these so-called joint review panels that are, you know...
You certainly do.
You know, and they're quite clownish and as far as, you know, as far as being in good faith. I mean, there is no good faith. Well, Anita, we're fast running out of time, but I wonder, you know, on a more sort of political vein, the specter of colonialism is still lays heavy on the land here, especially with First Nations, and it has so even become more acute over the last few years. When you say that you're fighting for the people of Clyde River's right to eat, I wonder if it's even deeper than that, a right to exist free of the colonial claws from the South, you know, that once their way of life is gone, they become slaves of the company store, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth to that for sure, because, you know, the failed policies of the government of Canada over the years has been so disastrous for so many communities and so many Aboriginal communities across Canada, to the point where many of these nations, it will take decades, if not centuries, for them to repair and restore some of the lost glory of a pre-European arrival. But my view is it's not too late for Nunavut. It's not too late for many of the Inuit communities. But in order for them not to suffer the same fate of many Aboriginal groups further south, their so-called Aboriginal rights and constitutional rights must be taken seriously. And it starts with proceedings like this. It starts with the NEB, and it starts with the Federal Court of Appeal, because the Supreme Court of Canada keeps telling us that the Inuit and the Aboriginal peoples of Canada have constitutional rights and a right to be consulted, but those words mean nothing if they can't be enforced. And that's really what this comes down to, trying to enforce those rights that everyone agrees they have, but when push comes to shove, the companies ask the courts to ignore them.
Well, and finally, Nader, was this your final venue? Like, if things don't go the way you'd like to see them go, is there another court to appeal to, or is this it?
I think if we were to lose here, I think we would probably seek leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. My clients have too much at stake to just accept defeat.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to keep fighting using whatever legal means they have at their disposal.
Well, Nader Hassan, thanks a lot for coming on the show and for the work that you're doing. It's worthy and definitely worthwhile, and I applaud you for it.
Thanks so much for your interest in the story.
All right, then. Yeah, bye-bye. And I want to also thank Dar Jamal and Janine for not showing up, but Mamia Abu-Jamal from prison. I'll play myself out now. This is something I found when I was digging through my archives. I've been doing that with the Guerrilla Radio archive shows and of years past, that when I were all on analog tapes and such. And I came up with this, and I can't properly attribute it other than it's Jessica Peanut singing We're Sorry. And this was with a video that I copied the audio from ages and ages ago, which can't be found anymore. At least I couldn't find it. And it was a very good video about the Iraq War and all the extreme damages that it has done, and expressing in some way, anyway, some small way, some measure of regret about that. That's all I got for this week, and Janine should be back the next time around. I implore you to stick around with us for all the great programming that you get here. Until the next time, that's all I got.